Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's Essential Morning Show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Here's what we're squawking about today. Billionaire investor Ken Langone.
That's like saying to a gambling addict, hey, here's $1 million, go on into the casino and have some fun.
Filmmaker Ken Burns on country's big bang for the music industry.
The origin is an intersection of commerce and technology.
And Joe, Becky, and Andrew watch what could be a key move by the central bank.
This is the first time the Fed has stepped in such a way, literally in 10 years.
We've got those stories and much more. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Wednesday, September 18th. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Straight up on Becky. 3, 2, 1. Up on Becky. Here.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Our guest host is BlackRock's Kate Moore. And Kate, good to have you here. Thank you
being
here.
First up on today's podcast, the murky market known as repo. What is it? The Federal Reserve has a $2.2 trillion repurchase system that allows one party to extend cash for equivalent securities. This can help companies short on cash to borrow quickly. The cash borrower agrees to repurchase those securities again at a slightly higher price. And the other day, the interest rate on that borrowing, known as the repo rate, shot up to 10%, about four times what's normal. So the New York Fed made the surprising move of shoring it up with an emergency $50 billion on Tuesday. Then they injected more today. Now let's get back to Becky.
Kate, we were just talking about this. All of these moves that were made in the repo market yesterday by the Fed, pretty confusing to try and figure out what was happening and why.
Yeah, look, I think there are a lot of people that are looking at all of these small events and asking, does it have bigger implications? Something Andrew and I were sort of chatting about as well. And in this environment where everyone's feeling really uncertain, where we have heightened geopolitical risk and the political risk and policy uncertainty, you know, I think these sort of fractures in the market make people more nervous. So whether or not this ends up being a much bigger issue, I mean, I'll leave that to the experts on the repo side, but I will note that this really does weigh on investor psyche.
But inside the office yesterday, this is the thing I'm trying to understand. I immediately had a 2007, summer of 2007.
Flashback?
BNP scare. And I don't know if you remember, but there was about $2.5 billion, maybe $2 billion that were frozen, subprime, that all of a sudden there was like a freak out. And at the time, it didn't feel like it was meaningful.
Yeah.
It didn't. And everybody sort of poo-pooed it and said, oh, it's just a technical issue. It's one problem at one institution. And then, of course, we know what happened later.
I would say the difference, though, private institution between what was happening in the repo market and the Fed stepped in right away and there was some action, right? So,
By the way, this is the first time the Fed has stepped in such a way, literally, in 10 years.
Yeah.
And the only other time it ever did something like this was in the middle of a crisis.
That's right. No, I think it's fair to ask, you know, is this going to be something like a warning sign and we're going to look back and say this is a start of a bigger fracture?
Sometimes technical factors really are technical factors.
Right.
Sometimes
but in general,
you say, wow, technical factors, you say, oh, yeah, they call them technical factors, but there's something looming. But sometimes technical factors really are just technical. I mean, there's nothing else that would.
I can say on the BlackRock trading floor, there was no panic. It was very orderly and calm and like a regular Tuesday morning. So.
It's interesting that there were like a handful of headlines, but just a smattering.
And right, trying to make sense of what it meant or why they were doing this. It was up to $75 billion, not entirely sure of how much they actually
It's happening,
did.
It's not happening, this is the window. I agree. It was a little bit confusing and something, of course, we'll be watching. But as I mentioned, I think like all of these small things that are impacting sentiment, you know, can together really weigh on, you know, how investors act through the end of the year.
Let's talk about oil this morning and the price of crude. Again, an issue where even 48 hours ago, there was a bit of a freakout. I don't even know if there was a freakout on the market so much as there were a freakout on the headlines.
Yep.
They jumped by more than 10% after the weekend attacks on Saudi oil facilities, but gave back much of those gains after Saudi Arabia said it would restore most of its oil output and return to normal production levels within weeks now. The kingdom's new energy minister said that 50% of production actually that was lost in Saturday's attack has already been restored.
Right.
We had an expectation that there might be a third of it back online by the end of this week, but 50% already is quite a feat, or at least ahead of where people were expecting things to be. He said the attacks won't affect, and this is also important because we were asking lots of questions on Monday morning over that weekend, it will not be impacting Aramco's upcoming IPO. Of course, that IPO has been delayed for quite some time, now going to be going public domestically in Saudi as opposed to on a major exchange. But moving ahead nonetheless, Aramco's chairman said the company is committed to that IPO taking place in the next 12 months. The country's defense minister ministry set to hold a news conference later today. And of course, we expect to learn a lot more about who the kingdom thinks was behind that attack. Iran's defense ministry this morning continuing to deny any role in the attacks, despite the comments and intelligence from U.S. officials.
We can't believe anything. Basically, I remember, it's going to be 6 months before we're back online. That was the original estimate for Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So at first...
You're saying you can't believe Saudi?
No, I'm saying that when you're trying
estimates.
To decide what to believe right after an event, that it's best to just...
Hold tight.
Yeah, just hold tight. I mean, remember, it's going to be 6 months. But if we had a six-month disruption of half of Saudi's oil, even though we don't import
Well, people
much,
were talking about, you know, they have a 35 to 40-day supply. How much can you get back on?
Right.
You're
but
already
6 months 50%. And I was thinking, wow, those facilities must really be damaged. And sometimes you think about, remember, like, we've had power go out, and it's like to get transformers around.
Legitimate analysts say things like, look, when there's even just a fire at a refinery or an oil operation, it can create lasting damage.
Right.
It takes a long time
to
go back.
In this case, it's not, obviously, it's not going to be 6 months anymore, right?
New developments in WeWork's push to go public. Still before year's end, CEO Adam Neumann speaking to employees in a webcast that took place late yesterday on Tuesday. He said he had been, quote, humbled by the shelved IPO and said that he had received feedback on the role that he needed to play as a leader of a public company. He then went on to say that the weak debut for other disruptors like Lyft and Uber contributed to his decision to delay the offering. I will tell you, I sat with him now, I want to say, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. We were on the record at the time. Uber's IPO had taken place, and I put the question to him, how do you react? How much are you focused on the Uber IPO? How anxious are you about it? Will it impact? And at the time, it was like, doesn't matter to me, completely irrelevant.
Well, it matter if he was able to get investors who wanted to invest at a price they were looking for.
Correct.
I mean,
I'm just suggesting that all of a sudden, dare I say there's an element of hypocrisy here.
Yeah.
It
doesn't matter if you can still get investors interested in you. Now, investors may be less interested in him, having seen what happened to Uber coming out, having seen what happened to Lyft, having seen what happened to Smile Direct Club. But it's because they kicked the tires maybe a little harder than they would have otherwise.
Right. If the price is right.
Right.
And the financials look good, you know, you don't have to worry about what's come before you.
Right.
There'll be demand for your shares.
Shares of Chewy, wider second quarter loss. I mean, I do everything I can for pet food and things. What'd you decide?
Yummy.
Three dogs. What'd you decide?
What do you mean?
What'd you decide about the possibility?
Oh, of a dog in the Sorkin household.
You try to just put it off, trying to, the kids will grow up before they realize they didn't get one or something.
Yeah,
I mean, how long can you stall? It is?
Yeah, but you know.
Designer dog, what are you thinking?
The boys watch the show. And so if, in fact, a dog was coming, I don't think this is, and it was going to be a surprise.
Well, let me ask you.
For example,
more I talk about it, the more they bug you, will this...
Can he impact your home life?
I already have the 3 hours.
The greatest thing in the world. And I think you'll get sick less, honestly. I do, because you believe me.
Because you'll be just around germs all the time.
A constant germ...
Yeah, you want the dog for the kids for the first 20 years of their life. For their immunity. I think at my point in the game, it's over.
It's stress relief. It's for mental health.
It's not mental and physical health. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
There's a reason all dogs go to heaven.
I'm gonna have to get you more.
They're
dogs.
All good. They're all good.
Dogs.
They are.
Right.
You know this.
I
do.
That was good.
I also have a golden retriever.
Flew right over his head. But.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful animals. All right. Ryan
Gohan's
going to be on later. He's got these little dogs.
He got you. Andrew, he was quick with that. I'm going to have dogs are good for mental health. I'm going to have to get you more dogs.
Oh, okay. I already got three. So, I mean, anyway.
All right. Thanks to Kate Moore. It's great to see you.
Cheese will be next.
Up next on Squawk Pod, billionaire and Squawk Box veteran Ken Langone on charity, taxes, and Trump.
If he was not the president of the United States and he was your child, you would be very unhappy if he behaves this way and said some of the things he says.
Have you met any of my kids yet?
This is Squawk Pod.
Welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Ken Langone is here. We're having our own conversation on the set. There he is.
There he is.
Hi, Ken.
Morning, everybody.
Good morning. It's great to have you
here.
Buckle up, people. We got 2 hours with Ken.
Buckle up.
I mean, this is a breakthrough that Andrew is here with you.
Oh, I agree.
Now, I'm just trying to figure out, did you not know he was going to be here, or are you facing your fears? Are you just deciding to do it head on?
Inexplicable coincidences.
Is why
a handful of times that I've either been traveling for...
Shrink said to him, eventually you got to confront the guy, you got to show up.
But you know what, Ken? If I were him, I wouldn't show up. You immediately started on him. And can I just ask you...
But in a nice way.
I know, but can I ask you a favor? Can you treat him as a CNBC employee, not as an employee of some of the other places that you've already been casting aspersions to him about? He's a CNBC employee. He's a Squawk Box anchor.
I'm going to
anchor.
Treat him as my friend who
okay,
needs advice.
Who leave
needs
that
advice.
Other
who needs advice.
Advice from time
leave
to time.
Those
from
other
time
media
time.
Entities out no, of
well.
The discussion.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that, supporting.
Let's just make sure our journalistic standards on this show, your show.
Stays.
You agreed to not bring this up just
now. I'm being positive.
We're going to stay at the highest level. That's what we're going to do.
We want to be the epitome of the best in journalistic
integrity.
Standards. The epitome.
Okay. All right.
Here we go.
Ken Langone is a billionaire from humble beginnings. As a teenager in an immigrant family, he dug ditches for the Long Island Expressway. That was long before he co-founded Home Depot and made his money on Wall Street. He's a veteran, a conservative, a big believer in the American dream, and an even bigger philanthropist. NYU Langone Health? Same guy. Free tuition at NYU School of Medicine? Yep, also Ken. Langone has been a CNBC guest for decades, so our anchors know him pretty well, and they're not afraid to debate, especially about the Federal Reserve and President Trump. Here's part of Ken's very spirited 2 hours on set this morning.
When it comes to the Fed, you don't necessarily think the Fed should be cutting here.
I don't think what this is all about, taking an aspirin before you have a headache. You take an aspirin before you got a headache?
No.
Okay. This is what this is.
Well, but y'all you want to take the antibiotic before it's like sepsis too. I mean, you don't want to wait till
you should not take an antibiotic until you need to.
No, I know,
that'll give you a resistance to antibiotics.
But you don't want to wait till it gets. You don't want to wait till you're actually really sick to take the antibiotic.
Look, where rates are right
there
now,
there are preemptive things. We may or may not be.
This is
a currency thing, right?
I just bought a company, closed on it last week, majority stake in a company. 2.63% for 5 years fixed.
Wow.
This is nuts. Right. You're being given, it's like saying to a gambling addict, hey, here's $1 million, go on into the casino and have some fun.
So from what you see in the economy, you don't think the economy warrants this?
Savings are up. Consumer debt is down. Equity in homes are going up and doing strong. The consumer, by virtue of their spending habits, everybody's sort of enthusiastic. I'd be careful about Christmas. But everybody's enthusiastic about this coming Christmas season. I feel pretty good about it. I don't know if I'm at 5%. And I don't know where the hell I am. But the point is, I do know that I think things are pretty good.
I think you could genuinely say, because I think this is actually how you feel, but you don't want to say it, that you like the results of where the country is today with the president in charge and that you want to give him credit for that, but at the same time you don't like the things that he says and the way he behaves.
No, I'm not saying No, don't put words on my mouth.
I'm
saying his style is different than mine would be, and I think I got to give him the benefit of it. He's the president of the United States. All these people that are after him ought to understand he's the president of the United States.
He could be whomever, but I imagine at some level I know you well enough to know that if he was not the president of the United States and he was your child, you would be very unhappy if he behaves this way and said some of the things he says.
Have you met any of my kids yet?
One Democratic presidential candidate is targeting charitable giving with new taxes. Robert Frank joins us with more. Hey, Robert.
Good morning, Becky. Well, the two economists who are advising Elizabeth Warren on her wealth tax are now pushing for a tax on charitable giving. Now, Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman at the University of California, Berkeley, say that as part of a new wealth tax, certain types of charity should be taxed to, quote, curb abuses. Now, the first is private foundations, which have about $850 billion in assets. So Bill Gates would be taxed on his $100 billion in personal wealth, along with the more than $40 billion that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have. That would include, of course, money given to the foundation by Warren Buffett. So Buffett's wealth would be taxed as part of Gates' wealth. Now, the second type would be donor-advised funds. Those, of course, hold about $100 billion in assets. The economists say that people who give to donor advised funds or private foundations still control that money until it's distributed to charities. So, quote, such wealth constitutes individual power. Hang on, Ken, we're going to get to you because I know you're going to speak up on this. End quote, it makes sense to make such wealth taxable. Now, Warren has not publicly announced how charity would be specifically handled in her wealth tax. The tax, of course, is an annual tax, 2% on wealth over $50 million, 3% on wealth over $1 billion. Ken, before you get outraged here, let me just explain what they're not saying. What they're not saying is when you give $100 million to the Langone NYU Medical Center or the Harlem Children's Zone, that would not be taxed. What they're saying is when you put that money in a foundation or donor advised funds, which is essentially warehousing that wealth, not going to charity yet, they say that should be taxed because you still control it, but it's not doing any social good.
You have a legal obligation once you put it in there.
Yeah.
To pay out 5%.
Well, with foundations, not with donor advised funds.
No, I'm talking, well, that's $850 billion. That's the biggest piece you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Donor advised, I don't understand. But what I'm saying to you is, I put
you've already gotten a tax.
The money that Buffett and Bill have put in there.
Yeah.
5%'s got to go out every year.
Correct.
Okay. That's automatic. It's a guarantee they're going to get. If they kept it themselves, they have no obligation.
Some would say that means 95% isn't doing any good and has already been written off taxes and is not being counted as their wealth when it should be.
Let me tell you
why. Because they control it.
The one thing this nation ought to be proud of itself for around the world and this city is philanthropy.
Absolutely.
Philanthropy is a decidedly American thing, and it's a New York thing.
And that's why I want to be clear. They're not saying you should tax the kind of philanthropy that you do. They're saying when you have a foundation that sits there for eternity.
Let me tell you.
And donor advisors, which considering.
Can I just put a fine point on this? Because maybe it'll help. I think the issue.
I'll take help from wherever I can get it.
I think there's a couple of issues here. The first is what I think they're really looking at, because I haven't talked to these folks directly, but a lot of people around this issue, is folks in a windfall year, take that money and rather than have it taxed, put it into their own personal foundation. Uh-huh. As a result, that money effectively does not get taxed and is not used for basic services, you get to direct that money. However,
if you didn't put it in, you don't have the obligation of paying out 5%.
Yes, you'll eventually have to pay it out. But the question is, in these windfall years, how should people think about that? By the way, the flip side, and I would actually make this argument, and Bill Gates has made the argument. One of the reasons that one of the biggest challenges is if you have a lot of money, is actually giving it away smartly in 1 year.
Let me tell you.
So forcing people to give a lot away the first year doesn't make sense either.
So there's sort of
a balance here.
Hold on, Ken. Doing it, that New Jersey Congressman Josh Gottheimer, and our guest host, you're the other half of the conversation, Ken, so you can do it. But I don't think Josh, we're necessarily or Congressman. What's the name of your group? You're barely a Democrat, but so you're not even gonna. I don't think you're probably not in favor of higher taxes at this point. You see what's happening in New York, New Jersey. I mean, now Carl Icahn's gone. Enjoy his money in Florida.
Well, I'm a proud Democrat, but I don't think the answer is at all to actually raise taxes on charitable giving. I think that's a big mistake, and you'll disincentivize people from giving. I think the point is right. You know, you of course want to encourage and ensure that money actually gets to charities and goes out the door to help people. That's the purpose of giving. But if you make a decision in that year to give it to a foundation and to get it right and to make a charitable contribution, we should encourage that. In fact, we should celebrate that. And the idea that we would do anything to disincentivize it, to me, is a huge mistake.
And let me tell you how objective. I don't have a foundation for one reason. Mm-hmm. I want my wife and I, we earned it, to decide where it's going.
Exactly.
I don't want to put it into a foundation where 50 years later, somebody's given something to a cause that I would not have any interest in or I might resent. But the bigger issue here to me is this. Believe it or not, I have 5 years to earn enough money to write off.
Right.
For example, when we paid all that money to NYU, there was no way I could earn enough money in those because it's a 30% limit on top of that.
Right.
That was a giveaway with no tax benefit at all.
Right.
Nothing changed in my life. My wife and I haven't given up.
Ken, you're doing it right. The question is, what about those who take the tax windfall? By the way, then they end up hiring their family members. Hold on. They end up hiring their family members.
Like the Clintons. Wow! Yeah, like
sure.
Clinton,
by the way, bingo.
Christ, everybody's
here,
getting.
Shake my hand on that. That's actually true, and it's a problem, and it was a big problem.
Worse than that, she had all of her campaign workers.
A huge problem.
The point is, there are people who abuse the system. You might not have abused the system, but there are people who abuse the system. If you want to use the Clintons as an example, go for it. But my point,
Well, how about Gates and Buffett? They're not abusing the system. They put billions of dollars.
This is not an argument about the Gates and the Buffetts. This is an argument about charity writ large, and the fact that there's a lot of wealthy people who've used charity and abused it, paying their families, paying for planes, paying for all sorts of things. So, yes, it gets put into charity, but all of a sudden there's costs on top of that charity. I mean, let's have a real conversation here about how this really works.
Let me tell you what bothers me a little bit. A lot of these people that are making these decisions will give you all the barbed wire you can eat for nothing. That's their charity, okay? They haven't given a nickel away.
Yes.
And they're sitting here saying, be careful. It works in America. Philanthropy. Go to colleges. Go to universities.
I agree with that. I think we have to make sure, and I think Hans making a great point, we got to be very careful with anything we do. We should make sure there's no abuse. We should make sure the money gets to charity. But I think we have to be very careful not to do anything that would disincentivize charitable giving. Just like we should find every which way to bring tax cuts back. And, I mean, we should be looking at all these things. But
are
this
you
is
on
not
board with a wealth tax, an Elizabeth Warren wealth tax, or you're going against that?
You know the answer to that. Of course I don't believe in that. You know, I think we need to make sure
very
that we
confused.
Look for tax.
I want to have
we should look
party
for tax.
For his
we should
Republican
look for tax
party membership.
Every time you're on, I say that the Republicans are leaving the lights on for you when you want to come home, Josh.
There's plenty of fiscally responsible Democrats.
I want to throw the party for you, Josh, when you come out of the closet.
Well, let's stick with charitable giving today.
Okay.
Congressman, thank you.
Next on Squawk Pod, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns on country music's connection to commerce.
He jangled the change in his pocket. He said, that's the Nashville sound.
Dollars, dreams, and heartbreak after this. This is Squawk Pod, taking you behind the sounds of Squawk Box on CNBC. Here's our green room at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square.
My name is Ken Burns. I'm at Squawk Box, and we're going to talk about the business of country music. I've just finished an 8-part, 16-hour series on the history of country music for PBS that is being broadcast this week and next week. What we've tried to adopt is a posture of sharing very complicated stories, whatever it might be in our history.
Stand by, Joe. 3, 2, 1, his mic, cue.
Our next guest's new film documents the roots of country music and the start of music as a business in this country. Let's welcome documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, whose new film for PBS is Country Music. And anybody that's seen anything you've done, Ken, I could watch anything you've done, but this really appeals to me, too. 16 hours.
16 hours. It's surprising.
And that's not enough time.
It's not enough time. Not enough time.
8 sessions?
It's eight episodes, 2 hours. One is a little bit more than that. I was totally surprised by the African-American influence on early country music, mm-hmm. about the role of women, strong women from the beginning. The original American guitarist is Maybelle Carter of the Carter family, about the tensions between commerce and creativity. But I was not prepared for the emotion. I'm a child of R&B and rock and roll. The emotion in this, when you hear Hank Williams say, "The silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky, and as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry."
Right.
I mean, this
You're
is poetry to, right? Yeah. mixed with yeah. music, which is the fastest art form there is, and it is one of the dominant art forms right now, musical forms.
Uniquely
in
American.
The country.
You can really, jazz too, but jazz has spread to become a global phenomenon.
So they're all the same. They're all variations of the same theme, and we tend to think that jazz or that country music is a separate one thing. It's not an island nation. You don't need a visa or a passport. It abuts jazz and blues and rhythm and blues. And with rhythm and blues, it's the parent of rock and roll. And it abuts country and gospel and folk and classical and rap and all these things.
And if you've seen Walk the Line or anything about Johnny Cash, you know it can be so.
Well, he's the patriarch of the whole
right.
story here. You know, we start with the Carter family, which he marries into, and we end with his death at the highlight of his career when he's working with a rap and hip-hop producer, Rick Rubin, and with Trent Reznor. So, there's no borders in country music, and that's the interesting thing. Commerce and convenience categorizes this stuff into these categories that just don't work.
You've seen him do personal Jesus. That is haunting.
It's unbelievable. He insisted on doing a gospel thing in every show he ever did and every one of his TV shows.
There are struggles, too, as you point out. Waylon and Willie go to Nashville. They're not going to fit in there.
Willie goes to Nashville and can't make it. He, in fact, gets drunk and goes out and lays out in the middle of Broadway outside of Tootsie's Orchid Lounge expecting to be run over. He wakes up, comes back, leaves Nashville, and can make it in Texas. And he warns his buddy Waylon, don't go. Waylon goes and says, I'm doing it on my terms, and totally revolutionizes artists' control of where they can record, who they can record with, what kind of production values that they're going to have. And so that outlaw movement, as much of us celebrating its otherness, was actually a wholesale takeover of the music business
at the time. Ken Burns redneck. I mean, this must be a surprise.
All my people come from the mountains of Virginia. My granddaddy and my daddy sent me stuff like that.
So it's in your blood.
It's in my blood, but it's in all of our blood because it's connected to jazz. It's connected to R&B.
What's the origin?
So the origin is essentially an intersection of commerce and technology. When you've got a phonograph, which has been around for a few decades, and you got this new medium of radio in the 1920s, you've got what were called race records, meaning the blues, being sold and then broadcast. And then somebody said, well, I wonder if there's a market for this old-time hill country music, which then became hillbilly music, which then became country and western, which then became just country. And so the creativity and commerce went hand in hand. Sometimes they fought, sometimes they didn't. When rock and roll was dominant in the 50s and country music sales dived, Nashville scrambled and started producing what was called the Nashville sound, having smoother strings, no fiddles, having backup singers, not scratchy nasal voices, and harmonies. And somebody asked Chet Atkins, a great producer, what is the Nashville sound? And he jangled the change in his pocket. He said, that's the Nashville sound. Meaning it was a business proposition from the beginning, and all of these things coincide. If you can't, you're not reaching people unless you're in concert with a business formula. And sometimes that works to the art's detriment. Right. Sometimes it works to its benefit.
From a business perspective, how is country done relative to the others?
So right now?
Right now.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, rap and hip-hop.
Second only to rap and hip-hop.
Yeah.
But hip-hop, I mean, but is it the gulf between where country is relative to rap and hip-hop,
relatively close, yeah. And it wasn't always that. This was hillbilly music looked down upon by most people. But the songwriter Harlan Howard called it Three Chords and the Truth. It acknowledges its musical simplicity, but that truth part means that it's speaking about universal human emotions that we all feel, like I'm so lonesome I could cry, about love and loss. And it's only because we don't deal with that that we disguise it and say it's about pickup trucks and good old boys and hound dogs and six packs of beer.
Yeah.
There's a minor subgenre of country that's about that, but most of it is about these songs. On the break, you were even mentioning songs that are specific to the intimate relationships between men and women. And country has been able to do that the way R&B. And I'll tell you something. When Ray Charles had creative control of an album for the very first time in his distinguished professional life, he shocked everybody in his crowd by recording modern sounds in country and western music. And the number one hit of the summer of 1962 was I Can't Stop Loving You, a country song by Don Gibson. Go back and listen to that this morning. And that's a country song. It's sung by a soul singer, but it's a country song.
There must be a lot of video. I mean, Civil War, you needed all stills. Right, and somehow... Right.
And I couldn't get an interview with Abraham Lincoln.
And exactly. But I couldn't stop watching that, even though it was all stills. This is all video.
We got 101 interviews. Only one of them's a historian. The rest are the singers themselves who know their history as good as any historian. We've lost 20 of those people, including Merle Haggard, who was our great before he passed away. We had 1,000 hours of footage that we distilled down. We looked at 100,000 photographs and used 3,300 in the final film, and we listened to thousands of pieces of music for the 584 music cuts that are in this.
I mean, rock wouldn't be rock either. The Stones, I mean, there's country everywhere.
They're all different. Every one of the Beatles got into music through country music. Ringo, it was Gene Autry and cowboy stuff. George Harrison, it was
Elvis.
Jimmy Rogers and the guitar playing of Chet Atkins. For Paul McCartney is the ballads of Marty Robbins, and of course for John Lennon, it was Hank Williams.
Yeah.
I'm so lonesome I could cry.
I mean, it's powerful, Andrew. I know you're probably not a big.
I made it for Andrew.
You got.
I didn't make it for you because I knew I had.
Yeah,
you.
Right. You got Waylon and then Shooter. You got what Hank's on like this fourth generation.
Oh yeah, no, his granddaughter Junior. Holly last night was our third episode called The Hillbilly Shakespeare, and she ends the whole episode by singing a cappella. I'm so lonesome I could cry, and there's not a dry. I got more texts and emails than for any film I've made last night from people saying, I was in tears. I didn't think I liked country music. I literally, I made it for you.
You made it for me, Ken.
And you
thank
can stream
you.
It. It's available for free from PBS.
Here? Fabulous.
He did a nice thing for you.
Yeah, I love it. I appreciate it.
I've been working for 8.5
Somebody
years
is.
For you.
No, not me. Don't, I know. I'm disqualified.
You might believe in the American dream again after
let me
watching
tell you
some
something.
Of this, Andrew.
Thank you, Ken.
God
bless you.
Ken Burns, thank you.
Ken Burns.
Country music is on PBS stations, so nice, streaming online. Ken and Ken.
Thanks
together. For being with us.
That's today's podcast. On our rundown tomorrow, a special episode from CNBC's annual Delivering Alpha Conference. We'll be on location at the Pierre Hotel in Manhattan. Joe, Becky, and Andrew will interview some of the day's speakers. Plus, we'll take you behind the scenes with our production assistant. Join us for the insights Wall Street is waiting for. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.